This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coastlines known for centuries are beginning to merge inland. Streets flood even without storms, and the surge from each hurricane seems larger than the one before. According to early reports, Hurricane Matthew set new storm surge records in many parts of the American Southeast. None of that is news to our next guest. John Englander is the American oceanographer who literally wrote the book on rising seas. It's called High Tide on Main Street, now in an updated edition. He's been the CEO for the Cousteau Society and International Seakeepers. Englander founded the Rising Seas Group to advise governments, industry, and communities. But John Englander also has a degree in economics. He can speak to the developing financial costs and social rearrangements we either make or will be forced to make. John Englander, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Glad to be with you.
When it comes to rising seas, can we say that all of us are witnessing the birth of a new age?
Absolutely. In fact, it's hard to see it because it is so new. For 5,000 years, sea level hasn't changed much because the planet has been in a fairly stable climate regime. But when we look back millions of years and see the ice ages, we realize that climate did change naturally. But now we are broken out of that natural cycle without getting into detail, perhaps, but the fact is we are entering a new era after about 5,000 years of stability. And seas will rise, the ocean temperature is warming, currents are changing, temperatures, rainfall, all of that.
In the first edition of your book, you predicted the kind of damage that hit New York and New Jersey with Hurricane Sandy. How did you know?
Well, what I was describing was a scenario for what would happen if we had a superstorm that happened to come up the North Atlantic and head toward the Northwest, and would happen to hit in Atlantic City, New York, and just to describe the kind of mega damage. The fact that that happened 1 week after my book was published surprised me as much as anybody else, frankly. I wasn't predicting it would happen then. I was describing scenarios to begin to help people see the future. A number of others have also happened that I described in my book as scenarios. But, you know, if you understand the physics properly and can look at the big picture, we all realize that to some degree we have a pretty good chance of our forecasts or our scenarios becoming true. And Hurricane Sandy was just an extreme example.
It's early days, but did Hurricane Matthew fulfill your expectations of higher storm surge?
Yes. Again, my expectation is to really step back and look at the big picture and say the ice is melting, the seas are rising, we've got more heat in the Earth's system, we've trapped it in the ocean mostly. And so the oceans are warmer, so we're going to get new currents, we're going to get more evaporation, which means more moisture in the atmosphere, which means heavier rainfall events, and these are going to manifest as these kind of strange storms, or weird weather, as some people prefer to say. And Matthew was an example of that. We're going to get these record-breaking temperatures and record-breaking storms and out of the pattern, and we need to get used to the fact that weather is going to become abnormal. In fact, abnormal will be the new normal. And Matthew was an example of that.
What's the role of the hotter ocean in these storms?
Storms, whether it be a hurricane, it's moving heat. And if you heat the oceans and the ocean currents change and the air currents, like the jet stream, changes, as has been happening more and more, it produces weird weather because our weather pattern, what the temperature will be, what the rainfall patterns will be, all came about because of fairly stable ocean atmospheric currents. And we know that if we put a pot of water on the stove and we turn up the heat, we can see the currents in the pot changing. And the same thing's happening with the ocean. It's hard to predict because the oceans are several kilometers deep. So we're seeing the Gulf Stream move a little bit and slow down a little bit. We're seeing the El Nino currents in the Pacific. All of these things are changing outside of their normal boundaries because we've cranked up the heat on the pot, the giant pot that is the world's ocean. So all of that does connect, and of course the evaporation comes as you warm water, you get more evaporation, not boiling, but just evaporation, and that comes down as heavier rain or even snowfall, and we're seeing that.
So could you take a little time and describe for us the slow but determined process of the ocean reclaiming land in the United States, for example, or if you wish, in other countries?
Sure. Again, we've had a fairly stable shoreline for about 5,000 years, which is pretty much human civilization. And the height of the ocean determines the shoreline at a macro level. And so the amount of ice on land, not the floating ice around the North Pole, which is floating sea ice, but the ice on land, which is from Greenland and Antarctica, is where 97% of it is, and then all the glaciers from Alaska across Canada to the Alps and Scandinavia, that's the ice on land. And the height of the oceans reflects the amount of ice on land. And normally this changes in a roughly 100,000-year cycle, with the oceans going up and down about 120 meters or almost 400 feet. We were ignorant of that because we happened along at the turning point between the up phase and what would have been the down phase as we entered a cooling period. But we've changed that. We've heated the oceans, and we are now melting more ice on land, in the first case Greenland, and then the glaciers all over the world. And the next to follow will be Antarctica. And it's a long-term trend. It's unstoppable now. We can try to slow it, and we should. And we also need to begin adapting to parts that's now inevitable.
So, John, this summer you traveled by ship to Greenland. Tell us about that. What was the purpose of the mission, and how did you get there?
Actually, we traveled to Greenland by airplane. Then once we were there, we went on helicopters and on ships. The purpose of the trip was the commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, Admiral Paul Zukunft, had me do a keynote or a briefing for all of his admirals 8 or 10 months ago. And the more he thought about it and we talked about the phenomenon of rising sea level, he realized that the U.S. Coast Guard had to be prepared for what was going to happen by mid-century. And that, too, he wanted to see firsthand this case of what's happening with the glaciers in Greenland, because icebergs are becoming more prolific as the glaciers melt, counterintuitively. And also that the melting and opening up of the Arctic seaways presents more shipping traffic, which is an issue for the Coast Guards, and potential environmental issues from oil spills and accidents and collisions with icebergs. But also that the opening up of the Arctic is why the world's weather is changing. So Greenland or the far Canadian Arctic are great places to go and look at that. So the commandant of the Coast Guard organized the trip and brought me along as his climate expert and met with his Danish counterparts to try and understand this so that the Coast Guard was always prepared, which is their motto, looking ahead decades into the future.
So do you think Greenland melt will happen fast enough to affect my listeners, the people living now, or are we talking about something for future generations?
Well, let's think that if a generation is 25 years or so, your listeners now, many of them will live past the turn of the next century, or some of them will, not maybe not your listeners, but certainly into the year 2050, 2075. And in that time frame, in the next 40 to 60 years, let's say, which covers two generations, and that would include your listeners, I would presume, that we are going to see sea level rise. In fact, it has just started, but it's just started so small that it's hard to notice. But Greenland will probably produce somewhere between 30 centimeters, or that's a foot, and double that, maybe triple that this century. The problem is Antarctica has 7 times the amount of ice as Greenland, and therefore 7 times the potential sea level rise. And the big potential change is how far the melting of the West Antarctic glaciers proceeds. That's the big question mark. We don't know whether we're going to get 1 meter or 2 meters from Antarctica this century. And we won't know, because predicting an ice sheet's collapse, and this is ice that's 3 kilometers thick, 2 miles thick, is kind of like predicting an earthquake or predicting an avalanche. If you're up in the mountains, and we all probably been there, and if there was enough snow precariously on the top of a mountain, they might tell us there was a risk of an avalanche. But they can't tell us when, just like we can't predict when an earthquake will happen. Well, the problem is that the 3 kilometers of ice on Greenland and bigger quantities on Antarctica, they're showing signs of early melting, and they're showing signs of collapse. And so we don't know whether we're going to get 30 centimeters, 50 centimeters, that's a foot or a foot and a half, or 3 times that in the second half of this century. But here's the reality that I always conclude for every group that I talk to, and whether it be corporate or larger audiences or conferences, we need to do 2 things. We need to slow the warming as quickly as possible, working on greenhouse gases. But even if we were 100% successful, even if we could bring greenhouse gases to zero today, which we can't, but if we could, we'd still get sea level rise. So there's no time to waste to start building higher. We know that sea level's been higher before. It's been lower. We know it's going to be higher decade by decade, century by century. Now is the time to begin planning for higher sea level.
Radio EcoShock.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the famous American oceanographer John Englander. We're talking about the arrival of a rising ocean on land. Well, your TEDx talk in Boca Raton, Florida was well placed. John, isn't Florida on the front lines of this onslaught of rising seas in America?
Yes, it is. And I happen to live here, which is why I did the local TED talk when it was here. But the fact is, Alex, you know, we really need to get out of our minds that this is just a Florida problem. And you're based in Canada. I was in Vancouver, not too far from you, last week. I was in Toronto a few weeks before that. I was in Prince Edward Island before that, in Nova Scotia. But every country in the world, from Bangladesh to London, Netherlands, to Singapore, Shanghai, Mumbai, every place in the world that's on the coast, and it's worse in places where the elevation, the topography is low, and, you know, doesn't climb too quickly. So Florida there is, of course, a good example, but Vietnam and Bangladesh are even worse, and more tens of millions of people in those places. We've got to realize that as sea level rises, it's every coastal city in the world, and it's not just cities on the coast, it's those cities on tidal rivers. So that would be up the Fraser River in British Columbia. That would be the St. Lawrence Seaway. That would be the Thames River in London. Cities from Sacramento, California to Hartford, Connecticut are 80 miles, 120 kilometers inland in the United States. They're vulnerable to sea level rise. We've got to really open our minds and realize that the shoreline is determined by sea level. And they've both been stable for about 5,000 years, all of human civilization. That era is gone. We should do all the good environmental things. We should certainly try and reduce greenhouse gases to slow the warming. But the third thing we've got to do is begin to adapt to higher sea level, which is now unstoppable, and it's not limited to Florida.
Do you think Miami will eventually go underwater?
Eventually, and so will the Florida Keys and parts of the Bahamas, and so will the islands in the Pacific and Indian Ocean that people fear about, the Maldives and Kiribati, and so will parts of British Columbia. And so, and again, will Miami? Yes, and it's iconic, and people think about it, and it probably has a more economic value at risk than any other city. But even if it happens over the next 100 years or so, and the flooding just gets more and more frequent in the meantime, again, we would do your listeners a disservice if we said it's a Miami problem, because the fact is it's a New Orleans problem. It's a Annapolis, Maryland. It's a San Francisco Bay. It's the truth is every coastal country in the world.
You talked about the financial angle of this. You have studied economics. Right now, currently, coastal real estate is the most expensive, but according to the science, many of these homes and businesses will become first uninsurable, then worthless, and then maybe gone. Could this trigger a financial implosion worse than the 2008 housing crisis?
Yes, but the difference will be that a financial crisis can happen almost instantly as soon as there's a realization of a problem. The growing awareness that sea level is rising will be a slower phenomenon, and the decline in property values will be slower, both because the realization and acceptance or the denial disappearing will happen over years or decades. But on top of that, sea level can't suddenly rise. I mean, I hate to say it, the good news about sea level rise is we have time to prepare. The good news is it can't happen quickly like a tsunami or even a sudden storm like Matthew or Sandy, but it's unstoppable. And the sooner we wake up to that and realize we have to begin slowly adapting, the better. And I think real estate values will do the inverse. I think they will slowly begin to decline, realizing that coastal real estate has a finite life as the sea rises and the shoreline tries to move inland.
And what about the economic cost of having to replace ports or big infrastructure like Boston's Central Artery Tunnel or the Big Dig or New York's subways? Can any country really afford this?
Well, the answer is none of them can and all of them will. And that sounds counterintuitive, because the truth is there's not enough money in the world to compensate people for the land that will go underwater. No government, not the United States, not Saudi Arabia, not China, could afford to make everybody whole with the new realization, which most people don't even have yet, but hopefully your listeners are ahead of the curve here, with the realization that sea level is permanently going to rise many meters. So nobody can afford that. Yet the reality is this isn't like an option, like should we have a preschool education or some kind of subsidized health care. If the ocean wants to be 1 meter or 2 meters or 3 meters higher, it doesn't matter what we want. And we will find the money to either move out of the way or build things higher or put in pumps or adapt to it. This is not optional.
As you know, our world is heavily influenced by big corporations who straddle borders all over the globe. John Englander, are big companies looking into the problem of changing oceans and have any contacted you?
I would say it's the early stage. Several have. I can't name them. Part of my being retained to help people think this through strategically is they want to be able to do it without it being public. So I have to sign non-disclosure agreements, as you'd imagine, and also with national security interests that are trying to look to the world of the future. But it's still the early stage. I would have to say that I've been doing this now for 6 years, I guess. I started writing my book 8 years ago. My book came out 4 years ago, 2012. And year by year, the awareness and interest is growing, but it's still early stage. For most businesses, to think beyond 5 years is kind of over the horizon. But if it's framed well, if we explain to people that this is inevitable, and that now is the time to plant the seeds for future businesses, for future communities, for estate planning, for strategic planning of how the world will change when the ocean is, again, 1, 2, or 3 meters taller, moving the shoreline in many kilometers in some cases. It's a disruptive idea. There are a few leaders, but year by year, the interest is expanding quickly.
Well, I'm hoping eventually, and it may be a tipping point, that comes out of the shadows and everyone says quite openly, yes, we're planning for this because it's obvious. Now, you've proposed intelligent adaptation. Can you give us an example?
Sure. In my book, High Tide on Main Street, as you cited, I come up with what I call the 5 points of intelligent adaptation. One is to act with a long-term perspective. If we step back and see where something is headed, we can actually plan and adapt better than looking at it day by day or year by year. So we have to realize that for sea level, that it's going to just get higher, you know, every tens of centimeters or every foot for Americans, but it's going to become meter by meter higher, which is 3 feet by 3 feet, if you will, as a round figure. And if we're going to invest in new structures and bridges and tunnels and higher buildings and seawalls, the earlier we can plan for where things are headed, the better return on investment. So that's one. The second is, as far as the projections for sea level rise, we need to recognize there's a range of projections that for the reasons I alluded to earlier, there's no way to accurately say how far the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets will collapse, which is what will ultimately cause sea level to rise by 60-some meters over the next several centuries or millennia. We don't know. Let's begin to act knowing there's a range. So whether the range of projection by mid-century is a half meter or a meter, by the end of the century is 1 meter to 3 meters, let's start adapting now, just like we do for a range of other projections for interest rates or the price of gold or the price of real estate or the price of gasoline. Three is we need to consider geology as well as topography, I like to say. So there's the slope of the land. How quickly does it rise up will determine how far inland the rising sea level will push the shoreline. But also there's geology. Miami is porous limestone, as are most of the coral-based tropical islands like the Maldives and the Bahamas and Kiribati. And those porous limestone locations you can't protect with a seawall because you could build a seawall right around the island or Miami, and it would just come up inside like a sponge. The fourth is we need to recognize that ultimately, the governments can't bail us out of this. They can facilitate, they can help transition, they can do some new policies, but to think that the government's going to buy everybody out of all of the coastal land that they own is naive. It may work for year by year, maybe a decade or two, but there's no government that has the resources to compensate their people for believing the shoreline wouldn't move in the long term. And five is, to begin, as you suggested earlier, that properties will devalue. And you wisely pointed out that we tend to put a premium price on coastal real estate. And to realize that the coastline is going to move inland over the next century means that for those that want to look ahead and adapt intelligently, that they can choose the time to sell or to move or to raise their house. But that would be an important part of intelligent adaptation, to realize that properties will devalue and we will need to either build higher, relocate, or adapt.
Some politicians, especially in Florida, but elsewhere, have doubled down on denial of climate change. We had the same thing happen in Australia and for 10 years here in Canada. And the whole issue of climate change has had less coverage in the current presidential election than the sex lives of the candidates. What happens if humans are not intelligent enough to act to save themselves from mega change in the oceans?
Well, you know, that's a great question, almost a philosophical one, and it's something I do grapple with. Are we smart enough? And where I come off on the two parts of this, the two facets, again, is we're seeing more flooding, whether it be a storm surge like during a Matthew or a Sandy or a Katrina event, whether we're seeing heavier rainfall event, we're starting to see more and more flooding, and people are getting worried about that. And you can't argue with flooding. And it's the question of whether you see the pattern. Whether we can be smart enough to globally deal with burgeoning population and need for energy and rapidly enough change our energy policies, that's, I guess, the human behavior and political question, economics. There's some optimistic signs that over a course of years, British Columbia, where you happen to live, is probably the best example in the world, frankly, where the tax that was put on carbon in 2008 and escalated pretty quickly is now a model for many other places. It reduces other taxes. It wasn't an additional tax. It was a replacement tax to put the price on carbon, but reduce other forms of taxation. And now Canada's recently announced, in fact, in the last few days, that it's going to try and model that policy and expand it nationwide. So I think we'll do those things. It'll take us a few years or decades. But, you know, the good thing about sea level rise, I say, it's not a choice. It's not a choice of whether to adapt. And, of course, we can fantasize about building cities underwater and so on. But that's we're not going to house 7 billion or 10 billion people underwater. The truth is, as the ocean rises for the first time in all of human civilization, we will adapt. The question is whether we do it by catastrophe and crisis or by planning.
After your trip to Greenland and your handy four-part series on changes there, what will you be working on next?
Well, I'm working to start a Sea Level Institute, the International Sea Level Institute. SeaLevelInstitute.org is a beginner website, and there's a little video there. We're looking to find the right base location and then to establish some nodes in different places in the world to help professionals like architects, engineers, bankers, town planners understand this and incorporate into what they're doing. So that's a real passion of mine. I'm writing another book, which I hope to have out in 2017. There's a group that wants to work on a documentary about my work and even a feature film. And I'm giving more and more lectures. Last week I was in Vancouver talking to the International Association of Aquariums. A few weeks before that I was talking to the Architects of Florida. So it's bringing different interested groups into understanding, and I love doing that, and for those that are interested, it's on my website. But speaking to groups, bringing groups of professionals and different cohorts, but even environmentalists like your audience, is really an important way to get the word out.
Our guest, John Englander, advises governments and private stakeholders on the science and financial impacts of rising seas. John is a well-known oceanographer with a wealth of experience, and he's put out a comprehensive guide for the public. Still a really good book, High Tide on Main Street. You can find a lot more at John's website at johnenglander.net, and I'll put helpful links in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. John, thank you so much for being our guest on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thank you. I love the focus of your program and the fact that you're on almost 100 stations, and I appreciate the opportunity, and hope that your listeners will pursue and consider this information in the weeks and years ahead.
Good. Well, I hope to get back to you as this whole story progresses, and as we know it will. I'm Alex Smith, reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. On January 2nd, 2014, A giant wave of cold and snowy weather hit Canada, central and eastern U.S. states. It stayed until March. On the nightly news, we heard the cause was the polar vortex marching south. Another deadly cold wave swept through Europe in early 2012, and then there was Snowmageddon in February 2010. So what happened to global warming? How could these extreme winter events happen while the Arctic is warmer than ever? Scientists are beginning to investigate this weird development. Theodore G. Shepard is the author of a paper published September 2, 2016 in the prestigious journal Science. The title is Effects of a Warming Arctic. It asks the questions about a relationship between heating the Arctic with human greenhouse gases and colder winters further south. In the United Kingdom, Ted Shepard is the Grantham Professor of Climate Science at the University of Reading. Dr. Shepard, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex.
Is it just North America and Europe? Where else have colder or at least snowier winters appeared in recent years?
No, the discussion has been in Europe, although it's also Asia, Central Asia, Eurasia and the Far East. So really, it's been across the whole, the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah, China got a cold blast a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, the thing is, you do get cold blasts in the winter. It is winter. And so that's the first thing to remember, is that we do have cold outbreaks, and we shouldn't be surprised by this. And I think a lot of people are just don't have long memories. So that's always something that we have to bear in mind.
Well, according to NASA, each of the last 15 months has set a record for global mean temperatures. Does that mean we've moved away from extremely cold winters?
Well, no, it doesn't. That's a statement very much about the global mean, the global average. And the global average, of course, averages over many, many things. It does mean that all things being equal, you would expect fewer cold winters. But the whole point is that all things are not equal, and climate change is uneven across the world.
What were you trying to do with your paper, Effects of a Warming Arctic?
Well, I was actually asked to do it, I guess, and science sometimes asks scientists to comment on particular topical issues. So I was really just trying to discuss the current state of the science in a balanced way. They wanted me to talk about some of the more recent evidence and just explain to people where things stood, because it's been quite a controversial area. So I was really just trying to lay out the issues without taking a position.
Well, what is the controversy among scientists?
Well, I would say the basic controversy is that, as you say, it is getting warmer, and we can even argue there's some basic physical reasons to argue that it should get warmer over land than over ocean, and also it should get warmer in the winter, warm even more in the winter than it does in the summer. So on the face of it, you wouldn't expect there to be an increase in cold winters. So if you just go with the basic, what we know for sure about climate change, then it wouldn't lead you to expect cold winters. But, of course, as I say, things could be different. You could have weirder weather. I talk about it in the paper just as a change in dynamics, a change of the jet stream and the polar vortex. Those are more exotic theories. They're ones where there's much less of a consensus, but, of course, things are possible. So really the question is, do you take a conservative view about climate change and just stick to what we know for sure, or do you look for the possibility of some more exotic behaviors that could be true but are hard to prove?
When it comes to jet stream, I interviewed Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers, who has talked about that distortion, but she told me something surprising. She said her theory really doesn't apply to winter storms. It's more summer weather that's deranged. I found that surprising. What do you know about this?
I guess I'm a little surprised, too. So I should, maybe I'm not up to date on exactly what she's talking about, because the warming is, you see it in the atmosphere in the wintertime. I mean, it's true that the ice is melting in the summer, but then what happens in the summer is that the ocean absorbs more sunlight and it warms up. Of course, there's more to it than that, but that's the sort of basic thing. And then in the winter, when you have really cold temperatures in the air, then all the heat comes out of the ocean. So when you look at the warming trends, they're larger in the winter than the summer. So on the face of it, you expect a stronger response in the wintertime. But it depends exactly on where the warming is happening and how close it is to the jet stream and so on.
Well, I better revisit that interview and make sure I got that right, because I'm not the scientist or the expert. But you know, some experts and bloggers immediately blame climate change for almost anything strange that happens these days.
Right.
Do we have hard science to back up the idea that a warmer Arctic is definitely causing some cold winter events?
No, I don't think we have hard science. And if you ask people for a consensus, you wouldn't get it. So if you went to something, asked a body like the IPCC to say, well, what do we know about this, it's going to be very hard. It's certainly not in the category of knowing that it's going to warm up. from climate change. Now, there have been a number of authoritative studies. The National Academy of Sciences tried to do a thorough study as well. But so it's much more mixed. It isn't hard science. But the issue is that we know the climate is changing, and so we can't necessarily take the past as a guide to the future, and we have to look for the possibility that there may be things going on that we don't fully understand. In other words, we have to take more of a risk-based approach. So the science is much more, you know, you might think of a public health outbreak with some very early evidence of something going on. So you wouldn't say it's hard science that there's a problem, but there is hard science in assessing what a risk might be, and that's a different kind of science, though. So that's where the controversy, I would say, lies in that sort of framing of the question.
And you've raised the issue of natural variability. Do we know whether periodic long weather cycles exist?
Oh, yes, for sure. And I mean, there's a lot of evidence in the observations, and if you run climate models for long periods of time, you can see very, very long. So, of course, in the real system, we know that the system is being forced by climate change, and we don't always know what's variability and what's climate change. But in a climate model, you can force it without climate change, and you can still see all these fluctuations. So you know in that case for sure it's just a variability. So that's the thing, and you can't rule out fluctuations. You certainly can't prove that what we're seeing isn't natural variability.
In a recent paper, Dr. James Hansen and a team of scientists warned that cold meltwater from Greenland could lead to a diversion of the Gulf Stream and changes to the storm track over the UK, where you live, in Northern Europe. This could explain the very stormy winters hitting Britain, France, and Scandinavia. What do you think?
Well, there certainly is hard science behind the fact that a lot of melting of the ice sheets in the high latitudes could change the Gulf Stream and the patterns of the ocean circulation, and that would affect weather. I mean, there is something to that, and you certainly see that in historical, you know, I'm thinking of paleoclimate and so on. Now, whether that would be affecting things now, I think that's much more speculative. But certainly that is a mechanism that the people have talked about. But that would really only, you know, apply to Europe. I don't think that would affect the Central Asian part, which has got to be more from the Arctic directly, I think, if there's an effect.
So it seems to me your paper concluded that we don't have to think about either natural variability or climate change, but we have to think about how they relate. Is that correct?
That's absolutely true. I think the idea of being either or is just clearly wrong. I mean, we do have climate change going on. I mean, just from a purely philosophical point of view, you know that the system has changed, and it's just not possible, philosophically, that there's zero effect of the melting Arctic on the lower latitudes. So the question is really, is it significant? Is it something that we can measure? Is it something that we have to worry about? And it's a nonlinear system, so you can't separate it into climate change and variability, really. They're all coupled. And I think that's part of the issue, too, is that some people, when people do a study, and it's the same for any extreme event, some people will say, well, it was mainly natural variability, and other people will say, well, it was climate change. And, well, typically it's a bit of both.
What about the storm named Juno that buried New England and the Canadian Maritimes with great piles of snow in January 2015? Is there a climate change connection there?
Well, it's important to separate low temperature from snow, because you can, of course, the really big snowfall doesn't typically come from very low temperatures. It comes from low, cold enough to form snow, but actually warm enough that you still get a lot of moisture. If it's very, very cold, it's also very dry. And so there are actually strong arguments for why climate change could lead to more snow, because areas that were too cold to have a lot of snow become warmer to have a lot of moisture, but still cold enough to have snow. So it's certainly very possible that those big snowfalls can have a climate change component. I don't know whether it's been assessed in a quantitative way, but there's nothing counterintuitive about more snow under climate change for those areas of the Northeast.
Radio EcoShock, bright voices in dark times. Get more, ecoshock.info. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Professor Ted Shepherd from the University of Reading in the UK. We're talking about climate change and weird winter weather. Well, Ted, TV weather people love to show us diagrams of the polar vortex, but what is that really?
Well, the polar vortex is just a belt of air circling around the polar region. That's why it's called polar and a vortex, because it's going in a circle. It's the same phenomena that is the jet stream that we encounter when we fly west to east or east to west. And it's basically just caused by the temperature gradients between the cold temperatures at the pole and the warmer temperatures at the middle latitudes.
I heard in a podcast you say that it was easier to attribute warming events like the deadly 2003 heat wave in Europe to climate change than cooling events. Why is that?
Well, it's really just because it's getting warmer in general. And so you know that the simplest explanation or the simplest expectation is that as you warm up the atmosphere, as you warm up climate, then if nothing else changed, you would just make every warm extreme warmer and every cold extreme less cold. So that's why it's a pretty straightforward connection, and you don't need anything special or exotic. But to get cold extremes that are getting colder, you need something a little bit, I call it exotic. It doesn't have to be, I don't mean it's breaking the laws of physics, but it's appealing to some mechanism that we don't have a lot of confidence in or other people don't fully understand. So simple arguments, I guess, are more believable arguments, and the more complicated that an argument is, the more that you might be a bit skeptical about it.
Speaking of cooling, you were co-author with John Marshall of an earlier paper looking at the asymmetry between rapid heating in the Arctic and apparent cooling of the main part of Antarctica. Since then, NASA has shown major glaciers in Antarctica are losing vast amounts of ice. Is Antarctica still cooling?
It very much depends on the region. And so, you know, when we talk about warming of the Arctic, it's a pretty straightforward thing in the sense that every data set that you look at, the entire Arctic is warming up, maybe some regions a bit more than others. In the Antarctic, it's much more complicated, and if you look at the patterns, it very much depends on which part of the continent you're in. So it's harder to make a blanket statement. And we can go into the reasons for that, but it's just, in a way, a more difficult area to understand than the Arctic, which is a classical climate change response. You see Arctic warming even in past climate. It isn't just CO2. You'll see it in paleoclimates and so on. But the Antarctic is more complicated.
Well, for one thing, it's a landmass instead of an ocean, and it has these high mountain ranges and all sorts of complicating factors.
Right. So it doesn't melt. You know, you don't have the ice albedo feedback in the same way that you have in the Arctic, where you melt the ice and you absorb more sunlight. I mean, there's just a massive block of ice. But probably one of the main differences is the fact that it's encircled by this ocean, very strong ocean currents, whereas the Arctic Ocean is comparatively feeble. I mean, it's rather shallow, doesn't have very strong currents, but the Southern Ocean is extremely deep, and there's this tremendous current, and that's a major choke point in the whole ocean circulation called the thermohaline circulation. And so that's a really crucial part of the climate system, which involves, say, deep waters coming out from below.
That same paper with Marshall helped me with a problem, Ted, that I've never completely understood. It's the relationship between the ozone hole and climate change, and many people in the public have those two confused. Ted Shepard, is there a relationship, and if so, what is it?
There is a couple of aspects, I guess. The one aspect is that the chlorofluorocarbons that cause the ozone hole are also greenhouse gases. So there was a warming globally from the CFCs, which is part of the climate problem. It's not a negligible part. It's, you know, through the last few decades of the 20th century, it was something like 30% of the effect of CO2. But then there's this regional impact. So when people talk about the ozone hole, they're actually talking very specifically about a climate effect over the high latitudes in the southern hemisphere. And there it's a really big effect. And there it's something which is not completely understood, but I think is strongly believed because there's multiple lines of evidence and models and observations, and that's that the ozone hole, it leads to a cooling of the stratosphere, of course, because you have less ozone and therefore absorbing less sunlight. And then because of the temperature gradient, because the cooling is localized over the polar region, that changes the winds. And then that change in the winds affects the surface climate. And so there's been quite a strong effect from the ozone hole, especially in the summertime, in the summer season of the summer hemisphere. You could say there's climate change caused by the ozone hole, which is different from the climate change caused by CO2. So they have some relationships, but they have some differences as well.
But that paper says that by mid-century, the ozone hole effects may instead be adding to greenhouse gas warming around Antarctica. Could you tell us about that?
So there's a kind of a simple, that's the ocean feedback aspect, I guess. The atmospheric, for example, it's been pretty well documented that the effect of the ozone hole on the winds and basically on the polar vortex in the southern hemisphere has been a strengthening, which is acting in the same sense as climate change. And actually, as the ozone hole goes away, as the CFCs come down over the next 50 years or so, that will reverse. But in terms of sea ice, I think there's a lot of debate about what's happening in Antarctic sea ice. And there, I think the story is still a very open story. And the Marshall et al. Paper talks about the role of the ocean in that and the fact you've got these different response time scales. And so even the ozone hole, you can't say that the ozone hole causes, say, an increase in sea ice or a decrease in sea ice, because there's one response on a relatively short time scale, a few years or 10 years or so, and then there's another response on a longer time scale. So it starts to get quite complicated, and you have to look at the whole history of the forcing. It's not just, you know, a simple cause and effect.
All right. Now, in June 2015, you co-authored a paper with Kevin Trenberth on extreme weather events and whether or not we can attribute them to climate change. I gather you had the same problem of weighing a changed atmosphere versus possible long-term variability.
Yes, that's exactly the issue. And again, it comes down to this issue of, is there hard scientific evidence? Or, you know, just because you can't prove that something is happening doesn't mean that it isn't happening. And if you're taking a precautionary approach, you have to ask yourself a different question. Can we prove that there isn't an effect of climate change? And that's a much harder thing to do. So it was a controversial topic, similarly controversial, I guess, in the sense of extreme events in the Trenberth paper, specifically things like storms and extreme precipitation, anything where there's a strong weather element to it. And for a lot of these events, it's very hard to prove that they're not just variability, because there's always storms, there's always variability. So the argument there was that we can't just be quite so conservative. We have to ask, given that the event happened, how much worse was it? And that's a different kind of statement. So we're trying to argue, therefore, a more precautionary approach to looking at extreme events.
Well, sure, in a perfect world, we could wait another 50 years to know what is natural variability and what is not, but you and I know the climate threat is so urgent, we can't wait that long. What is to be done?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. If you wait, when we talk about heat waves and we talk about the thing where the science is absolutely firm, then there's not really a problem. We know that ice is melting in the Arctic, and that's because of climate change, and we know that the global mean temperature is warming up, and that's because of climate change. And you could say we've already waited too long. I mean, we've definitely dug ourselves into a hole with climate change, but the observations are clear on that respect. But if we're talking about weather events and these and a lot of these dynamically related extremes, if we wait until the observations are clear, it'll be much, much too late. So we need to start thinking about acting before we have the full evidence. And that's a complicated thing, because it means looking at the climate models, but the climate models give various stories. Sometimes they don't always agree. There's reasons that we can't necessarily trust them. So we have to use our knowledge of basic physics and, you know, mechanisms. And it's a much more complicated. It's a very interesting scientific story to say, how do we bring together all the evidence, and how do we distinguish between plausible threats and implausible threats?
Well, we don't like complex systems or complex answers. Do you worry scientific caution may confuse the public, maybe actually delaying climate action?
Well, that's, of course, the worry, is that if we use the current, as kind of what I would say, the conventional scientific language, then we just bury everything in caveats and no one does anything. But, you know, I had a bit of a debate with a climate skeptic once a number of years ago. This was after Katrina had hit New Orleans. And he was saying, oh, you can't prove this is climate change or whatever. And I just said, well, if you were the head of civil engineering in New Orleans and you had to rebuild the levees, and a climate scientist said, well, we expect sea level is going to go up because of climate change. We don't know exactly how much, but we're pretty sure it's going to go up. And we also think that hurricanes might be more intense. There's a bit of it's a bit of a controversial topic, but there are some pretty sound physical arguments for why the most extreme hurricanes might be more extreme. So would you build the levees higher? And he said, of course I would. So it does seem to me, if you put people in a position where they have a decision to make, a concrete decision, and you say, let's weigh up the evidence, shall we make an investment to protect ourselves, then people will make a certain choice. So I think the key is not to get lost in the abstract question, but to think of very specific questions and very specific actions.
Well, this past summer was hot again in Alaska, northern Canada, and Siberia. Do you have any ideas or predictions? I hate to use the word predictions to a scientist, about what kind of winter we'll get this year in the northern hemisphere?
Oh, I wouldn't want to make a prediction. kitchen because winters can be highly variable, and there is a business of trying to predict what will happen in a particular winter. It's called seasonal prediction, and people certainly do work at that a lot. I don't actually know what the predictions are for this winter, so I wouldn't hazard a guess. But in any case, the skill level is not very high in the sense that there's just a lot of variability, a lot of chaos in the system, so I wouldn't want to hazard a guess. So.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about your work or your research group and where it's going?
Well, I guess where I'm struggling or challenged by, I guess you could say, is trying to find the right language to talk about these things, and I hope that's maybe come through in the interview, is that the challenges that we're facing in climate science is how to talk about risks without sounding completely uncertain, but also without losing sight of the things that we do know for sure. So it's kind of a tricky line to walk, I think, because we do know that there's absolutely clear risks from rising sea level and rising temperature and so on. Then we have the risks that are a little more tricky. For example, the California drought has been a major controversy and, issue, I should say, and then controversy among climate scientists, and how much of that might be due to climate change and how worse might things get in the future. Those are very difficult questions where you can't really prove things at the same level that you would like to. We can talk about things like rising sea level. So how do we talk about that in a scientifically a defensible way? So that's where I'm trying to think of the right ways to frame things and actually considering new approaches like storyline approaches is something that I'm thinking about. So rather than trying to be probabilistic, you say what's plausible, which is a different question, and working with psychologists about how you frame questions and things like that. So I think this is where a lot of the new areas are going to be, is actually how we talk about the science, because it's not the usual way that we would do things. If you're running a experiment at CERN about particle physics and you don't have enough data, you just wait till you have data. You wouldn't try to publish. But we're dealing with an urgent threat here, so you have to make decisions based on what you know. It's a different kind of scientific problem.
From the University of Reading, UK, we've been speaking with Professor Ted Shepherd. He's the Grantham Professor of Climate Science. He's a much-published scientist and an expert in atmospheric circulation, among other things. And you can find links to Ted's university website and the papers we've discussed in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Ted, thank you so much for sharing your time and work with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
I made a mistake in that interview with Ted Shepherd. The melting of the Arctic sea ice in the summer can affect the type of winters further south in North America, Europe, Russia, and even China and Japan. It's an important point, and I'll clear it up with some clips from my past interviews with Jennifer Francis. Plus, I'll put more links and explanation in my show blog at ecoshock.info. But first, I'd like to tell you the good news, bad news, about the new global agreement to reduce warming impacts of the gases used in refrigeration and air conditioning. On October 15th, 200 countries signed a deal to limit and then phase out the use of the chemicals HFCs used in refrigeration. These hydrofluorocarbons are in your fridge and car air conditioner right now. They're in the big freezers, in grocery stores, and giant commercial air conditioners in buildings across the world. HFCs are hundreds of times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Some say they are thousands of times more powerful. The aim of this treaty, which is an amendment to the 1987 Montreal Protocol, is to avoid half a degree centigrade of global warming that would have hit the planet from the overuse of these chemicals alone. Considering the current alleged safe limit is only 1.5 degrees C of warming over pre-industrial times, and we're already pretty well at 1 degree, it sounds like refrigerants could push us into dangerous climate change even if we stop the coal plants and car exhausts today. It's a big deal, half a degree of warming. It's also a bittersweet moment for me and for all environmentalists who remember 1987. At that time, 25 years ago, the Greens and a few scientists warned loudly that switching from CFCs, which did destroy the ozone layer, as well as being greenhouse gases, to HFCs was a huge mistake, We knew even then that HFCs were a potent greenhouse gas that would add up to damage to the world's atmosphere. I was there in the fight. We warned them. Frankly, the biggest CFC producers, including the DuPont Corporation, dragged their feet and fought off CFC regulations. Until they had a new product to offer, HFCs. And that's what the chemical industry pushed. HFCs were more expensive and gave the chemical companies another few decades of big profits. There were other safe alternatives already known. These included things like propane, butane, and ammonia. More research and development might have done even better. Nobody listened. The world cheered as our civilization turned from one damaging chemical to another. People around the world are installing more and more air conditioning. It's becoming an air-conditioned world, and no wonder it's getting hotter and hotter. As HFC sales soar, the damage and further heating became too obvious to ignore. So now, finally, and too late, the governments of the world are prepared for a slow, painfully slow, phase-out of yet another greenhouse gas. The deal allows China to keep making and installing HFCs until 2024, and India until 2028. That's where most of the new air conditioning and fridges will be sold. When those units break down, need to be replaced, or just leak, the HFCs will continue to pour into the atmosphere for more decades into the last half of this century. You will be told the refrigerants will be collected and burned, but let's get real. This isn't happening now in most places and won't in the future. We're committing to releasing very powerful greenhouse gases as we try to cool ourselves on this hotter planet. Maybe that agreement was the best anyone could get. It's something. But it won't save us from the ravages of climate change. We need a drastic change to refrigeration and air conditioning, with the whole conversion by 2020 at the latest. Like CFCs, the sale of HFCs need to be criminalized very soon to save what's left of our atmosphere. It's time for new pressure and campaigns to get that done.
This is for all the protesters who are standing up along the line, standing up for what you believe, and it doesn't matter what the price. This is for all the peace lovers who are peacing out on this great land, peacefully being passive while the aggressors are getting out of hand. And I just want to thank you for your passion and conviction. I just want to thank you for your never gonna give it up attitude. I just want to thank you for your passion and conviction.
Let's get back to the jet stream and Arctic ice science. Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University pioneered this science. Here's what she told us on Radio EcoShock in 2012.
I should mention that in the summertime, the extreme weather that we get in the summer is actually probably not directly linked to the sea ice. I think it's actually directly linked more to the rapid decrease in the amount of snow cover on high-latitude land. Over the last couple of decades, while the sea ice has been melting, we've also been observing that the snow has been melting ever earlier from high-latitude land areas. And this has a very similar effect as the sea ice does, but in a different season, of course. And what happens is when you remove the snow earlier, you expose the soil to the strong spring sunshine earlier, which allows that soil to warm up earlier. And so you end up with the same situation that I described for the sea ice, where you're enhancing the temperatures at high latitudes in the Arctic more than lower latitudes. So the same thing's happening. You're reducing this temperature difference, which also weakens the jet stream and I think is playing a role in the drought that we had this year in the U.S., heat waves, and other summer types of extreme weather.
And now here is the update in our interview in March 2015. Another challenge for research has been the different patterns in different seasons. The last time I talked with you a couple of years ago, you seemed fairly sure about what was happening in the fall and winter, but less sure about the spring and summer. Is this Arctic change affecting all four seasons now?
Well, we think it is. And since we talked a couple of years ago, there's been a lot of research been done by a bunch of different groups around the world looking at this linkage between Arctic change and weather patterns in mid-latitudes. And what we've learned is that the mechanisms that are creating the linkages vary with season and with location. so there isn't sort of one story we can tell that explains this linkage. A group in Germany, for example, has been looking at connections between ice loss in the Arctic and summer extreme weather patterns over Europe and Asia, and finding that the loss of sea ice in the summertime is contributing to these sorts of extreme events because that warming in the Arctic is causing the jet stream to split sometimes in the summer. It's more likely to do that when there's less sea ice. And when the jet stream splits, it tends to trap these waves in the jet stream, and they tend to stay in one place. And that leads to some of the extreme events that are related to very persistent weather patterns, like heat waves and drought and flooding. So that's, you know, one of these mechanisms that have been studied that is just a summer mechanism. There are others that people have been identifying that occur only in the wintertime. One of these that appears to be very robust is a link to ice loss over Western Russia in the Arctic area just north of Western Russia, and that seems to be causing the tendency for very cold winters over Central Asia. So a lot of people are looking at these various aspects of the linkage, and we're learning a lot.
I hope that makes it clear to everyone. The rapid heating of the Arctic will create unstable weather in the Northern Hemisphere. In the winter, there may be nastier snowstorms, even punishing cold snaps, in large regions. In the summer, there can be longer and hotter heat waves, droughts, and of course extreme rainfall that just stalls over a large area due to the lazier jet stream. Changes to the Arctic from our release of greenhouse gases are so profound, they are one of the biggest signs and proofs we have entered the new geologic age, the Anthropocene. You can review this program, and I would, and you can pass it on, please do, by downloading it for free from the show website at ecoshock.org. Let's get everyone informed on the climate reality behind the weird weather porn we see on TV. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.